Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, and welcome to The Plays the Thing. My name is Tim McIntosh, and I am here with Sarah Jane Bentley. Sarah Jane, how are you?
I'm really well, Tim. Thank you. I'm joining you from the balcony in a mansion on top of an escarpment, looking out over Lake Ontario.
That sounds really miserable. What?
Yeah, pouring sunshine on me.
What took you to Canada?
I'm here just being a mentor on a Christian camp.
Oh, that's great. Is this something that you've done repeatedly? Is this your first time doing it?
I've actually never done it before. So I've been learning as much as the campers have, and I've really enjoyed it.
How are the fellow campers, how are the campers treating you?
I think they're kind of a little bit intrigued by my accent. And I get the sense that I think the word the Canadians use is saucy, that... I think I'm coming across as like a bit stern or a bit strict or a bit more bothered about rules than perhaps I should be. I don't know.
And they're
not trying to, but
their word for that is saucy.
Yes.
How do you use that word in England? Saucy.
Saucy. What would be the equivalent? And maybe, I don't know, like saying you're a bit blunt, a bit abrupt.
Gosh, I think that word in the States, I think people would say that you're sassy if they meant you're saucy. If they said you're saucy, I think they would mean you're sassy. Like, you've got a little bit of a wit and you're not afraid to use it with ill intent. That's what I would think. But who knows? Maybe I've not been using that word properly. Welcome from your beautiful outlook. And now we have to descend into the purgatory, which is Act Two of Othello.
Yes.
we talked last week about how the play feels claustrophobic, and it seems like an act two. The walls are being set up, and they're going to begin to close in as we progress through 2, 3, and 4.
That's right. That's a really good point, Tim, because the play begins in darkness, doesn't it? And now, at the beginning of Act Two, we're in the middle of the night. It's really dark. And there's a storm, and it's so confusing, the whole atmosphere, that they don't even know who's coming in off the sea, whether it's the Turks, whether it's Othello, whether it's Iago's ship. We're still in the darkness, and it's very similar to Macbeth in that sense, that
both the plays
take place in the darkness a lot. And you're right, it gets more and more claustrophobic to the end, where in the last scene, we're kind of right in the chamber with Desdemona and Othello.
Right. And as a piece of stagecraft, I think it's really interesting that we don't know. So the scene is being set by these kind of secondary characters at the top of Act Two. And they tell us that they're worried about this storm and that Othello is in the storm. And then, what do you know? Someone sees what they think is his ship, but it actually ends up not being his ship. It's the ship that has Iago and Desdemona. And so they arrive first. And the great enemy of our play, Iago, gets to set the scene about what's going to happen before Othello arrives again, which I think is a very clever bit of stagecraft, that our narrator, basically our narrator is the character with the ill intent, and he is the one that constantly is pushing the action forward in this play.
You're right. And it's a mirror of Act One, isn't it? Where we began with that conversation with Rodrigo and Iago. So the first things we learn about Othello color our judgment against Othello, because Iago tells us about him.
Right. Iago's is always telling us about everyone. Okay. And one of the things that we learn in Act Two is, well, really in Act One, we learn more about his motives. And one of the potential motives, we talked about this at the end of the podcast, one of his potential motives is that he suspects that his wife has been unfaithful with Othello.
That's right.
And we meet Emilia in Act Two. What's your impression of her in Act Two? What does she seem like, the sort of person that would be faithful to Iago, that might cheat with Othello? What's your impression of her?
Well, I think anyone married to Iago is going to have their work cut out to even find time to have an affair with somebody else, because it seems like she's having to spend a lot of time defending herself. And, you know, she's pretty sassy, in fact. You know, she gives answers to Iago when we first hear them discussing the insults that Iago gives her about what wives are like. He paints this horrible picture of women, and she says, "You shall not write my praise. You know, I don't want you being the testament to who I am," which is a terrible situation to be in a marriage.
Because
your husband should be, you know, your greatest defender and protector. He should be the one singing your praises. So it seems like she must be quite independent, I think, in some ways.
And yet, she does Iago's bidding in Two and Three. She does exactly what he wants to do. So how do you reconcile that?
Well, I think there's a kind of frailty in the human condition, isn't there? Where, despite the fact that she knows that Iago's praise is actually a condemnation, that scene where she captures the handkerchief for him, she does seem to be desperate to gain his affection. So maybe it's the difference between her in public with Iago and her in private with Iago.
I wonder if in private, if she's terrified of him. But in public, can kind of play a little bit of a role, because she has the kind of protection of other eyes around her.
That's right. Yes. And she can appeal to, well, Desdemona, for example, for some kind of support.
Right. Okay, I'm going to ask you the same question about Desdemona. We learn a little bit more about her in Act Two. In Act One, my impression of Desdemona is the faithful, wooed wife who's a little bit transfixed by Othello, partly... because of his strangeness, partly because of his strangeness, meaning he's not from Desdemona's world, and partly because of his exploits. She says that he wooed her, kind of recounting what happened during his battles, and that's what she fell for him. So now the curtain is being drawn back a little bit more about Desdemona. Is your opinion of her changing? In Act Two, is it staying the same?
I think Desdemona's really fascinating. The interesting statement we get about her from Iago, which again is not entirely trustworthy at the end of Act One, is that she's a super subtle Venetian. He calls Othello an erring barbarian and Desdemona a super subtle Venetian. So he suggests that she's duplicitous, in fact. Which stands against all the epithets that are used to describe her. She's described as, you know, divine Desdemona by Cassio. And as we talked a little bit about her being a bit like Venus, the goddess of love in the play. And so you're right, she's full of virtue. But when she first meets Iago on the shore here, or first kind of publicly speaks to Iago on the shore in front of everyone in Cyprus, she, I don't know, do you think she's being a little bit flirtatious? After
yes.
Emilia said, "You shall not write my praise," she says, "Oh, well, Iago, what would you say about me? You know, am I any better?" And, you know, we spoke as well, didn't we, about how in the source, Iago is absolutely flat out, hands down, in love with Desdemona.
Uh-huh.
And he says in this scene a little bit as well, not in this scene, but in this act, he says, I kind of love Desdemona. I'm a bit in love with her, but it's for pragmatic reasons.
Uh-huh.
So,
And he articulates his intention to seduce her, which
seems to be.
But then he drops that. I don't recall anywhere in the play where he is actively pursuing that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's true. And she is a really desirable woman. And it seems like the men are in love with her, but not necessarily in a kind of lustful way. They just mm-hmm. admire her as this paragon of virtue, I think Cassio does. And Iago, I mean, if anyone can be called a misogynist, that's a term that's used so loosely today, Iago can. But I'd go further and say he's a misanthropist. He doesn't just hate women, he just hates people. He hates everyone. So Desdemona, we have to pity her, because if we don't, the tragedy doesn't work. So she's no fool. She is enchanted by Othello's stories, but she says something like, I had a vision in my mind of what he was like. And she seems to understand him. And throughout the play, she shows a kind of a willingness, an altruism to try and always create harmony where there's disorder. She wants Othello to forgive Cassio, for example. And the problem is that Iago's so aware of this, he's able to twist her virtuous actions.
Yeah.
I mean, how would you cast Desdemona if you were going to direct this production?
I think for the play, I think that she has to have a sense of innocence about her. I think thus I think she would have to be a little bit younger.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if she is Othello's peer in any way, I think it diminishes the kind of the pain. I mean, it's a strange thing. You want to inflict, you really want the play to hurt. That's what makes the play work, is at the end, it's so unbearable. And I think if she is not as worldwise as Othello is, if she's younger than him, but yet also, I think that she really believes in Othello. Like, I really think that her affection for his exploits is really genuine. It's not, she's not putting on just to kind of like win this man's affection. I think she's genuinely impressed by him. Don't you?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think what you said about age is really important. We know that Iago's 34. Isn't that what he says? He's 34 years old.
That's right.
And he's always making dirty, smutty jokes about the sexual relationship between Othello and Desdemona, as if Othello's too old and, you know, he's going to kind of run out of the energy of passion.
Uh-huh.
And Desdemona is so gentle. You're right. She's not, she does have a kind of innocence about her, but she's not completely naive. If we're looking at this conversation on the shore, Iago does respond and start to praise Desdemona with these jokes. They're kind of, remember we had the Doge in the first act speaking in proverbial couplets, which was a very serious way to give a lesson. We now have Iago doing the same, but with the opposite effect. He's now speaking in couplets to give a load of proverbial nonsense, really. And Desdemona says, almost lame and impotent conclusion. Do not learn of him, Emilia, though he be thy husband. Is he not a most profane and liberal counselor? So she does seem to have an authoritative voice because she has a moral authority over Iago.
Okay, how much of that authority over Iago is because of her position and how much of it is because of her character?
That's a really good way of looking at it. I think it's both, isn't it? Because
yeah, I think it is, yeah.
She's the daughter of a senator. She's now the wife of the most powerful general in the Venetian army. And Iago's just the ancient.
Yeah. Yeah, just the ancient, which is going to drive, drives him crazy, or at least didn't play. I read something by John Gielgud, the famous actor. Mm-hmm. I think he played Othello, or he at least directed Othello, but I think he played Othello. And he made an interesting comment that he did not think that he could actually believe in the character of Othello unless he believed that Othello was completely sexually innocent previous to Desdemona.
Right. Yes, that his couch has been the bed of war.
Yes.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So there's, in a way, there's a kind of naivety about Othello.
Right, right. And I mean, part of, it seems like any marriage is the spouses, the couple, each kind of have a a picture of what the other is like when they first begin to meet each other and hopefully begin to fall in love. And then the reality sets in, and it seems like, and the reality setting in can be handled with compassion and dexterity, or can be handled, it can be handled in a poor way. Like, what did you do with the person that I thought that I was marrying? You know, that could be the response. And it seems like if Othello is indeed sexually or at least romantically innocent, well then, what great troubles he's going to have when he discovers, or when he fears that Desdemona is not being faithful to him. He has no experience to pull on. This is just perhaps like the way of women or the way of this particular woman. And he has no alternative vision of what she might actually be like.
Exactly. And that's why at the end, the final scene, he doesn't try to use, you know, if he'd only used love to conquer all of this confusion that Iago's created, he might have triumphed, but he doesn't. He uses what he knows, which is violence and in war, in the marriage bed, and it's disastrous.
It's tragic.
But the other problem is, so we're talking a little bit now about Othello's marriage to Desdemona. His marriage counselor, if you like, is Iago, who thinks that marriage is a frail vow.
Yeah.
And, you know, Iago doesn't believe in love or virtue. He's already said to Rodrigo, virtue of fig. Mm-hmm. Our wills garden our bodies. Our wills cultivate us. Our desires cultivate us. And so marriage is being undermined by Iago from the beginning. And he is more experienced in marriage than Othello. But his experience is not—it's not instructive. It's the opposite.
Yeah, that line, "Virtue of fig, 'tis in ourselves that we are thus or thus. Our bodies are our gardens, to the which our wills are gardeners." It's one of the most disturbing. It sounds—it's very philosophical. It sounds plausible, but I wonder for someone in Shakespeare's time, would they hear this and say, oh my goodness, this is a profanity of the worst sort? Or would they say, no, this is plausible. This is something that good people can believe.
I think you're right. I think they would be, as Macbeth said, so gospeled that they would hear this as a very kind of dangerous philosophy by which to live your life. Uh-huh. They might I don't know. It would be quite, perhaps some of the nobility in the audience might by this time already know about Machiavelli.
Yeah.
Who has a kind of idea about politics, which suggests that people in power live by a different morality to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, what they want to do is law, essentially. So yeah, I really struggle with this little passage from Iago because I find him a bit contradictory. He says that, and then he goes on to say, but we have reason to cool our raging motions. So he seems to then be painting this picture of people who have, on the one hand, hot passions, mm-hmm. and then on the other hand, cold reason, and life is a kind of battle between these two things.
Right.
So it's quite a sort of dualistic picture of a human being. And I think, you know, Christians in the audience probably, well, I'd hope would recognize that as being untrue.
The I'm glad you brought Machiavelli. So listeners will probably know the name Machiavelli, but just in case he's a little bit unfamiliar.
Mm.
The famous work is The Prince. He's an Italian, and Machiavelli is an advisor to kings, and he writes this book that to this day, Sarah Jane, people debate whether or not The Prince is actually meant as a straightforward advice book, because it is all about how kings have to actually rule. And he's writing during the time of, there's this kind of notion of the divine right of kings, that kings can, or queens for that matter, can rule in great virtue and great justice. And Machiavelli's The Prince seems to just rip the mask off that, or attempts to rip the mask off that, and says, listen, that's not actual real politics. That's not the way that kings have to actually rule.
Mm.
They have to actually rule with great force sometimes, because they're constantly in threat of being assassinated. They're constantly under threat of foreign invasion. They're constantly under threat of kind of barbarity taking over their kingdom. And so it's nice to pretend that the king can just be virtuous and honest and never duplicitous. But let's be real here. The king has to, he has to rule with an iron fist and a velvet glove, you know, and that's what The Prince is about. And I think it's really interesting that Shakespeare, at least in two plays, makes reference to Machiavelli. The one that comes to mind is Richard III.
Thinking about Richard III as well.
He says something to the effect that he'll put Machiavelli to shame. He's going to act with Richard III act with such darkness that he's going to put Machiavelli to shame. So yeah. I think you're right that like, English nobility would probably know who Machiavelli is enough so that Shakespeare could name drop him.
Yeah. He died in 1527. This play is something like, where are we? 1603, 4?
So a generation and a half earlier.
So I think probably he would have been well known. And Iago and Richard III and Machiavelli, that's a brilliant comparison to just, perhaps we could just draw that out a bit. What does Richard III say? He says, but I am, that I'm not shaped for
sportive tricks.
Yeah. Made for court and amorous looking glass. And he says, in this weak and piping time of peace, I cannot prove a lover, and therefore I'll prove a villain. And
he hates
the idle pleasures of these days. And the worst thing that could have happened for Othello really is that the storm conquers the Turkish fleet. And now we are in a time of peace, and Iago goes about all kinds of villainy because there isn't this necessity to fight a war. And
right.
So it's a great comparison to
me. What's the old phrase, idle hands or the devil's workshop? I don't know where that comes from. It's so true. It's so true.
An idle mind is the devil's shop.
Yeah. Sarah Jane, you teach Shakespeare. Do you have kind of a common approach? If someone asked you, okay, I really want to try to tackle Othello and I've got a class of 20, how do I do it? How would I go about it?
Yeah. I mean, I can talk a bit about this. I would have a class of 20 and I'd also have about maybe 3 or 4 months to teach it.
Mm.
With maybe three and a half, 4 hours a week to do that. So I'd be thinking in those terms.
Okay.
And I've only ever really taught with, unfortunately, a kind of a final exam destination in mind. So that can be quite restrictive. But I've...
Can I ask you a question about that, about the final exam? Yeah. Do you write the final exam or do you have to adopt somebody else's final exam?
No, I don't write it. It's actually written by a kind of an exam body that serves the whole country. So
okay. We
have lots of past papers and have a pretty good idea of what the essay questions will be and how long they'll have to answer them. But okay. It is quite reductive because it takes all the teaching of an amazing play like this or Macbeth or Coriolanus. And then there are 45 minutes to write an essay about it and that's it.
With those as like one of your restrictions,
yeah.
How would you tackle this? How would you tackle this play?
Well, I have, since discovering the Circe Institute and listening to Andrew Kern, I've kind of tried to park all of that and teach from a state of rest, so not be anxious about any of that. And I try to teach with some really strong first principles. So at the beginning of the course, I might begin by looking at maybe between 6 and 10 big ideas in the play that we're going to be revisiting again and again throughout the lessons on the play. For example, for this one, I'd probably start with words and the power of words in the play. I'd look a bit at how Brabantio in the first scene denies their power, how Othello thinks, as we said, that he's not very good at talking, and yet clearly he does have a very eloquent turn of phrase. How Desdemona seems to be seduced by words, how people's language breaks down in the play, and how Iago uses language to powerfully twist Othello. So that would be one thing. And then, you know, I'd build in a few others as well, probably look at recitation. Then we spoke a bit as well, didn't we, about that metaphor of we've got love and war going on in a kind of conflict where those two plots sort of come together, either as a backdrop or the foreground. And I kind of start with that, I think. And I teach through conversation like this. This is yeah. How my lessons are a lot of the time.
Sarah Jane, do you ever read any of the play aloud with the students, or do you assign it and presume that they've done the reading outside of class?
A bit of both, really.
Yeah.
It's really fun to read the speeches aloud and try and do a little bit of improvisation in the lesson. We spoke at the end of the last podcast on Act One about some good resources, and the Royal Shakespeare Company's National Theatre live productions are available. So I often, if it's Shakespeare, I try and show it to them. So I'll either take them to the theatre or we'll watch it and then discuss. And every week they'll write an essay. So they write an essay a week.
And how much do you have to work to convince your students that Shakespeare is not a museum piece, that he's actually really great?
I don't have to work very hard to do that at all.
Okay, why not? Why not? Because do students come equipped with that? Or what's the background such that you don't have to convince them of that?
Yeah, maybe it's something I really take for granted and I should be more grateful for it, that I'm just really blessed to teach very bright students who don't really struggle to understand the language very much. So it's already accessible, perhaps. But I think, you know, as Hamlet says, Shakespeare's plays hold a mirror up to nature, and they do see aspects of human nature in these characters. I think all children do. And what we have to do as teachers is make sure they're aware, you know, okay, it is a mirror, but it's also a window. We're trying to see those faults, look beyond them, and then, you know, try and practice some of the virtues that we see.
Right.
As well.
I ask because when I was in high school, and I would say even in college,
yeah,
I was not a good student, first of all. So that's the qualifying caveat that may explain everything I'm about to say. I did not, I thought Shakespeare was the most boring, it was something that you had to do in a literature class because your teacher was a romantic who didn't really understand the world. And she liked Shakespeare, or maybe she didn't even like Shakespeare, but she had to teach it because it was part of the course requirements. You know, that was kind of my opinion of Shakespeare. And I think, honestly, it was really late for me. It might have even been when I saw the Lawrence Fishburne Othello in the cinema that I realized, oh my goodness, Shakespeare is alive, and he is. Oh, and I'll tell you another one. There was a Mel Gibson Hamlet that was done in the 90s, and I remember going to see that. And there's a particular scene. This actually might have been the moment for me.
Okay.
If you remember, after Hamlet has killed Ophelia's father, he's summoned by the king, and the king has all of these, I don't know, what are they, maps or documents out on this table. And Mel Gibson rushes in knowing that he's in huge trouble with his father-in-law, the king. And he leaps up on the table. So he's kind of towering over. Do you remember this scene?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And I remember just thinking, previous to seeing that movie, that Hamlet was this kind of an abstracted philosopher who is, you know, just melancholy and along with people. And then I saw Mel Gibson play it and I thought, this is different. And Shakespeare is really, really thrilling. So I feel like my job as a teacher, when I have taught Shakespeare, is I've oftentimes had to kind of do first things first, which is let the students fall in love with Shakespeare enough so that they will do the work and I'd have to do, the teacher doesn't have to motivate them to care.
That's right. And I think, you know, you've highlighted some really important things there for all of us as teachers, that we mustn't, you kind of have to trust that the play is that powerful, that it is going to capture their imagination, try not to chop it up too much. So I do like to show them the entire play first.
Absolutely.
So there's no sense of like every lesson you're walking line by line through the play and looking at every word and analyzing, because that really kills it.
Right.
I think they need to hear it and see it, as you said. They need to actually hear it and see it and know that this is a living creation that's meant to be incarnate on a stage. And those, if we can do that first, then hopefully the play will just captivate them and enchant them. And then our job is easy. Then they should come with questions and be like, so this bit, that bit when he jumps on the table.
Yes.
What's that joke about? Why is that funny? Or what is a body of politic worms mean?
Yes, right. Yeah.
So I don't know. Do you find that your students that their imaginations are not captivated by Shakespeare, or have you had some experiences of teaching it that are more kind of, I don't know, fruitful?
They've always been, how do I say this? There have been some classes where I have had to, I think they come preset, the students come preset to think, kind of like I thought, that Shakespeare is a relic behind glass that we have to study because our parents, our teachers, the state, you know, whoever insists that we, you know, think Shakespeare's a big deal, but really he's just as more. Because I think also, I wonder if you're, I think of the English speaking world, Great Britain and the United States, both love Shakespeare, but I do think that as Americans, that 16th century language is just a little bit farther away from us perhaps than it is from your students. And so it's just a little bit more opaque. The plays are a little bit more opaque, at least on the page. So for me, I do the exact same thing that you do. If I can get my students to see a really commanding performance of the play, then my work is 90% of my work is done.
Right. And then it's just, you know, playing around. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Then it's just having fun. And you don't even realize if your students fall in love with the play. And boy, what a play to fall in love with as a young person. A story about a story that is driven primarily by jealousy. I mean, I just remember as a young person being so worried that, you know, my girlfriend or my love interest was either not interested in me or interested in somebody else. And boy, that will keep you up at night, you know?
And these are the questions with which I often begin my lessons. So I try to start with a really big question that I haven't linked to the play necessarily, and then build in and build in and build in and try to teach through analogy and say, okay, well, what is jealousy? What's the difference between jealousy and envy? When is it right for a husband to be jealous? Is Iago jealous or envious? And then kind of, okay, let's compare Iago's jealousy and Othello's jealousy and try and, you know, questions like that, I think they're really interested in. And I think teenagers, they always want to pass judgment on people.
That's so true.
He's wrong. And that's great. Let them. And then just say, okay, why? What is it? Who's worse? Who's better? What should you do in this situation? What should Othello do? What should Cassio do? And the more Shakespeare they know, the better they are at reading Shakespeare.
I bet. Yeah.
Shakespeare reads Shakespeare. So if I'm teaching one play, I'm hoping to take them to go and see another one, and I'm encouraging them to read other plays by Shakespeare. And I often cross-reference, just try and show them the fullness of it rather than being reductive, you know?
Yes. Yes. I took students, I think I mentioned last week that there was a, there's a great Shakespeare festival that runs practically year round about 3 hours south of Gutenberg where I used to teach. And whenever there was a Shakespeare play, especially one that coincided with the curriculum, I would take a big group of students down there. And I remember, they were just such a wonderful production team. Everything they did was just good. And I remember there was an incoming freshman. She had arrived early for the summer to Gutenberg. And so I took a bunch of students right when the school year began to go see... the most famous comedy. What's wrong with me, Sarah? Beatrice and Benedict. What's wrong with me?
Much Ado About Nothing.
We saw Much Ado. Yeah. And I think that this young woman had never seen... I know that she'd never seen a Shakespeare play. And I wonder if she'd ever... I wonder if she'd not been to a live performance theater before. Yeah. She walked up to me afterwards and her jaw had just hit the floor. She could not believe what she had just seen. And part of it was the theatricality of the performances. I think Shakespeare is so conducive to a great theatricality, meaning props and stage accoutrements and lighting. So there was a scene, I think the kind of, I'm doing so poorly. The other couple, not Beatrice and Benedict, the when...
Claudio and... I don't know either.
I know.
I can't even remember the name of the main character.
Claudio. When Claudio leaves her, they're about to get married and Claudio leaves her, the production had this... It was incredible. They had a huge, just a pile of cut flowers that was waiting up above the stage, invisible to the audience. And the whole play had been kind of like replete with these kind of like visual thematic elements of cut flowers. And when Claudio leaves her at the marriage altar.
Yeah. Hero.
What's that? Hero. That's right. Thank you. The middle of the stage is bare for a moment. All the characters are kind of like around the stage. And from the middle of the stage, the lights change into this kind of like glaring white spotlight right in the middle of the stage. And from the rafters of the stage falls this huge, just a pile of cut flowers, and they just explode all over the stage. And it was so stunning because it was unexpected, but it was thematically germane.
Yeah.
And I remember this young woman walked up to me afterwards, and she almost couldn't speak. She could not believe what she had just seen. And I thought to myself, all of my work is done. I don't have to really do anything else in the classroom because she just fell in love with this thing.
Yeah.
And now she's going to show up for class. And sure, of course, she showed up for class and she was absolutely involved. You know, she was in there throwing punches and making points and listening, and she cared so much. Mm-hmm. Because Shakespeare just does it. He just is. I mean, certainly the English language poet, I shouldn't say certainly. He is, to me, the English language poet of all time. And it's so delightful that he might be, I mean, he is up there with the world poets of all time. And he wrote in our language, Sarah Jane. That's he wrote in our language.
That's right. And I know we can, critics and teachers can kind of idolize Shakespeare, but that's right. He isn't the author of humanity, but certainly he has a really good understanding of it. And I would just really encourage parents and teachers not to be afraid of the language. Don't go for the kind of abridged version.
Agreed.
Just take a really deep dive and it's going to be okay.
And I have found also, I try to encourage teachers and parents, don't be afraid of encouraging your student to memorize a brief bit, especially if it's a complete thought, not just an excerpt from a monologue, but if it's a complete thought, and have the students memorize that and have to stand up and perform it. That can be intimidating, especially because the language can be very difficult. But something happens when you have to get those words out of your body in a public setting.
Yeah.
Something happens, something different.
I can't remember. I was reading something about why we should study poetry, and I'm just paraphrasing, but it was something like that those words give a kind of structure to our thoughts and feelings that we can't express. And so when you learn them, it helps you to be better attuned to reality, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. The younger students I've taught throughout my career, I've always had a competition of a Shakespeare declamation where they can choose a speech they like, or I might direct them to one, and they all have to learn it. And it's, at least 20 lines long. And as you say, they have to stand up and recite it. And then the best ones compete, and we'll get a judge to come and sort of choose the best one. Yeah.
And how did they respond to that? Did they fuss over it?
It's always different responses, I think, but generally, you might get some children who are less inclined to learning stuff by rote, but they really enjoy the ideas, and the others are maybe really good at learning stuff by rote and might not understand what the words are at all. So in some way, it's going to appeal to all of them, I think.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So I think that, what you were saying about, the spectacle of the play, I was just wondering how, as a director in Act Two.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you were directing this in the Globe, you've got no electricity.
Yeah.
How would you do this scene where they arrive off a stormy sea and it's the middle of the night?
Oh gosh. Well, yeah, you threw a really hard question at this director. That's a really hard one. Can I answer a different question? I would like to think about that for a little bit.
Sure.
I'd like to think about that for a little bit. What I've been thinking about, I think I read less as a literary critic. When I read Shakespeare, I read less as a literary critic and I read more as a director. I really oftentimes think okay, where would I have Iago stand? What would the blocking look like? And do you know what I think would be, if you had to direct this in the globe, there is a huge obstacle that would need to be overcome, which would make, and I think almost the success of the play is really contingent upon this. And what I think is, I think you have to have Iago in a position to seduce the entire audience. I think we all have to stand near him. Like, he's so repulsive as a character that I think unlike, say, Macbeth, or unlike even Richard III, I think we stand in, I'm going to say it about Macbeth and not Richard III. We stand in proximity, in close proximity to Macbeth, and we allow him to like speak directly to us, like to our hearts, you know? And I think that that's not there with Iago. Like, I never have felt, man, I'm just going to give myself to Iago. I'm just going to.
This is going to reveal more about me than Iago, but there are times I find Iago so funny. Whereas Macbeth, apart from the scene with his armor bearer, Satan, where really Macbeth is the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
Macbeth isn't very funny, whereas Iago's hilarious. And I totally get Iago's impatience with Rodrigo, who's a bit of a fool.
Right.
Iago's put downs are so, so funny. And also I can sympathize with Iago's Iago's pretty fed up with all of Othello's boasting as well. And right. So in that sense, I think Iago could get a lot of laughs out of the audience. And then that's the thing that's got you, because by the end of the play, you realize, oh no, what have I been laughing at?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. When you laugh with him, you're laughing at the cost of another character or characters on stage, and it helps you stand closer to Iago.
Exactly.
I think the big obstacle in producing this play at somewhere like the Globe, where you have no, it's just a huge outdoor theater and you've got no electricity. So the big question is, how do you have a single character whose soul is bespotted and besmirched in like every possible way? How do you get him to whisper into the ear of the audience without any sort of amplification? And I think, you know what I'm saying? Do you see that? Is how that would be a problem?
Yeah. I suppose, have you been to the Globe? Have you seen any?
No, I never. I've seen productions, filmed productions of it, but I've never been there.
Oh, well, you must come.
I know.
Yeah. I think one thing that the Globe does that's a little bit anathema to us now, because we're so used to audiences sitting down in rows and not moving or saying anything for the whole performance. In the Globe, there's much more movement, and that barrier between the stage and the audience is much less kind of absolute. And so, you know, for Iago to be wandering through the audience or talking to people directly or making jokes at the expense perhaps of the groundling staff, I don't know, like a pantomime element to it that we don't get now in some productions of Shakespeare, which can be very serious, you know.
Yes, right.
So yeah, I think you're right. Iago does need to be close to the audience. Yeah.
And to somehow have him do it without the appearance of shouting. That requires an actor who has real vocal capacity. There's no other way to say it, real vocal capacity. Let's talk about the Globe for a little bit.
Okay.
I am watching a Globe production of Othello. I think I mentioned it last week, with Tim McInerney playing Iago. And one of the things that I love about it is that there are probably maybe three or four camera angles that look like they're preset around the perimeter of the Globe. And during some shots, you will see characters that are on stage, and behind them, you'll see what looks like another character kind of at the very periphery of the stage. And then you realize, oh, that's not a character. That's someone who bought a ticket and is kind of leaning. They're actually on the stage, sort of leaning on the stage, because that's how close they are to the action.
And that's, you know, in As You Like It, that image, all the world's a stage. The globe is a metaphor. And people went to the globe to see the play, but they also went to people watch, because you could be in the theatre and get a look at the queen or the king who's going to be sitting there too. And you'd see all the nobility in their fine clothes, and the nobility would see the guys who'd wandered in off the docks, perhaps in their lunch break. I don't know, gutting fish, or chewing horses. And so it is this wonderfully diverse microcosm of the globe. And the sky is above you, and the evil characters come up from underneath the stage, which was called hell. And we don't always get that in a modern theatre setting. Yeah,
I read a book about it was called something like the year 1601.
James Shapiro. Is it that one?
That might be it. I hope I hope I got the
59.
Say it again.
Is it called 1599?
That's what it is. That's what it is. And there's a story in it about, and correct me if I'm wrong, Sarah Jane, it's been a while since I read the book, Richard Burbage, who probably played Iago in Othello, who played Hamlet, who probably played all of the major dramatic roles in the tragedies, and probably Benedick also. One of the great, great actors of the English stage, and is, you know, best known of his affiliation with Shakespeare. He and his brother owned, was it the Rose Theater that became the Globe Theater? Is that right? And the theater was on one side of the Thames River, and I guess the lease ran out, or their rental agreement for that particular piece of property expired, and the property owner would not allow Shakespeare's troupe, including the Burbages, re-up with them. So what did they do? They were evicted. Right. And so in the middle of the night, and this was in, I think, 1599, in the middle of the night, Shakespeare's troupe goes to the theater, breaks down the theater. They must have hired like tons of workmen to help with them. Put the theater on a boat, sail it down the Thames, and put it up on a new piece of property. Do you know this story?
Yeah, that's how the book starts. I know, I was fascinated by it. And it shows how the company of actors that became, it was the Chamberlain's Men and then the King's Men, were, they were kind of super skilled. They could be carpenters. Shakespeare wrote plays, he also acted in them and directed them, and there was that kind of, you know, sense of just mucking in, because they didn't have a, so they just built one themselves. They carried all the bits of wood across the river. There's a big thing in London that south of the river is kind of where all the bad stuff happens, and so south of the river was where the theatres were. It's where the bear baiting happened. It's where the cockfighting happened. And it was kind of a bit seedy. And so the river was seen as this kind of separation between the kind of, I suppose, more genteel society and then the wildness on the other side of the river. It's not a very accurate divide, but...
It's not a very accurate
now, divide. Of course, whereas now, of course, going to the theatre can be seen as something
posh.
I don't know. Yeah, that you might save up to do for your 50th birthday.
Yeah.
It's not for everyone. But that's not how it was at all in the globe.
I think that's a shame. One of my dreams is to do kind of guerrilla theatre because theatre prices are so exorbitant today. And I feel like this major... Yeah. I mean, it's one of the oldest standing art forms in the history of the world, if not the oldest. And it's becoming more and more just something that people who have great wealth can afford. And so I think people are they're not falling out of love with theater so much as they just are completely unacquainted. Like this young woman that was like entering my school, I don't think that she had ever seen even a play. And it was stunning to me.
Whereas if you were an Athenian, then it was state-enforced theatre for everyone once a year, wasn't it?
Absolutely right. Everyone, and they built theatres large enough for everyone to, for the entire polis to kind of participate, because
Yeah.
It was like, it was like, how could you be a citizen in a polis without being like really involved in the theater? That's impossible.
Yeah.
Exactly. I miss that vision of the theater as not just as an entertainment, but as like part of state and culture craft. I really miss that. It still plays the role of culture craft, I think, but in ways that we don't really recognize as readily as in previous times, namely with the Greek polis. Sarah Jane,
exactly. And Shakespeare was operating under constraints in that he was clearly fascinated in politics. He was writing after the Reformation. There's all kinds of interesting religious tensions that haven't worked themselves out yet in England. And yet there's this character called the Master of the Revels who would see every play. And if he thought that there was anything treasonous in a play, Shakespeare could be executed.
Right.
For treason. So I think he's this kind of stealth social critic, really, where he'll take us to these foreign lands and give us these characters from history and from mythology and other stories in order sometimes to try and point out some stuff to us about what's going on
right
now in England.
Right. And you're right. Like, he's walking the razor's edge.
Yes.
And also, you have to say, if he's obsessed with one concept, for me, if he's obsessed with one concept, it's the concept of maybe the fragility or the strength of kingly power.
Yeah.
I mean, in every, always looming in the background is some sort of threat from a foreign invader, even in this play. This play, it's hardly even part of the plot. You could almost, except for the fact that Othello must be a great and powerful general, the whole engagement with the Turks for me is a sidebar that could be eliminated. But still, he puts it on the horizon because I kind of have this sense he's a little bit obsessed with it. He lies awake thinking about this, does Shakespeare, about the nature of kingly rule, what happens when kings abuse their own conscience, as in Macbeth, as in Richard III, and what happens to a civilization when this single ruler either comes under threat from foreign activity or comes under threat by his own misdeeds and lack of virtue.
You're right. And Shakespeare's so attentive to his audience, isn't he, that he writes a play for everybody, that he's not writing for the intellectual elite or the very wealthy, but he knows the king or the queen is sitting there in the audience alongside everybody else. And I wonder with Othello, because as you said, it's difficult to figure out what's going on here in terms of kingship, because Othello isn't a king.
Right.
Nations aren't going to rise and fall in this so much. Venice is a little republic. It's pretty stable. It won't be conquered by the Turks. And I wonder if it's because he's writing probably in the first year or so of King James's reign. And so he couldn't really go in and start speculating about that. He had to be really careful. He didn't know how the king would respond to this. And you can see how later, when he finds out that James I has this fascination with
witchcraft,
then Shakespeare kind of jumps on that and starts to play around with that in Macbeth. And I wonder if in this play he's being a little bit careful, but that's just my theory. So I think that in this play, he kind of gives us, okay, let's do something safe like barbarian versus Christian. Let's just see how that goes down. And I wonder if that's maybe what's going on in Othello.
That makes a lot of sense to me.
Hamlet's, for me, much clearer. And I really don't want to advocate political readings of his plays. I don't think that, you know, all his plays are kind of about political power or anything. But it is interesting to look at the historical context. And for me, something like Hamlet, you've got Denmark, which is this state that is gross, it needs weeding, it's kind of overblown, it's self-satisfied, it's complacent, which could be a picture of the reign of Queen Elizabeth towards the end of the Golden Age. And then you've got this young up for it fighter, Fortinbras on the outside, who comes in at the end and kind of smashes everything. And I wonder if that's Shakespeare saying, look, do we need to be a bit more on our guard here? Elizabeth's not going to live forever. She doesn't have an heir. Let's not be asleep in the garden, you know?
Yeah. Let's not be asleep in the garden lest we get poison poured in our ear. Sarah Jane, let's start moving toward the end. What do we look for in chapters 3, 4, and 5, especially chapter 3? What sort of things are you going to be reading for as we go forward?
Well, one of the things about this play, as you said when we first spoke about this, is that sense of constant building up of tension and the pace of it, that it's got this steady flow, which is almost unbearable. It's almost the leisurely pace at which Iago proceeds is terrifying, because he feels as if he has this control. And so in this act, Act Two, which we didn't talk about very much, he effectively ruins Cassio's reputation. And he has Rodrigo, where he wants him. He's made his fool his purse. And Rodrigo is getting increasingly anxious because Rodrigo is running out of money. So as we go into Act Three, you can see how Iago is positioning all his pieces on the chessboard to go in for the kill. And so now we need to think about how is Cassio going to respond to his pride being damaged like this in public, because he's a Florentine and he's one of the curled darlings. And, Iago makes fun of him for always kissing his three fingers, you know, that Italian gesture of kind of going, oh, ciao, bella, and kissing. And Iago's always making fun of his, of the kind of excesses of Cassio. So Cassio's wounded. And if we're looking at this in a Machiavellian sense, Iago's got quite a few victims here who he has neither crushed nor consolidated. So there's plenty of room for things to move around. Mm. We've got Desdemona lined up with Cassio. Iago's going to try and exploit Desdemona's virtue there. He's started to sow seeds of doubt in Othello's mind about Cassio's reliability. And so in Act Three, we're going to see how that augments and how Iago increasingly isolates and alienates Othello.
Yes. I love the comparison with a chess game. It's a gambit that Iago is playing. And it looks to Othello one way. And so he is going to just walk into this trap. And everything has been arranged for Othello to walk into this trap. And once he has walked into this trap, he'll be toppled. Be toppled.
So Othello's two closest advisors have been brought into disrepute by Iago, his wife and Cassio. And in the position of Cassio, we have a lieutenant who has guilt and shame. So he has done something bad, and publicly he's going to be admonished for that. But then in the case of Desdemona, she's a guiltless character who is, because of Iago, starting to gain this kind of shameful reputation as an unfaithful wife on no basis whatsoever. So I think that's going to be interesting to look at as well, the relationship between guilt and shame.
Yes. I'm going to keep my eye on Amelia. Because I think Amelia, we did a podcast yesterday, Sarah Jane, on the Odyssey, and we were talking about Helen. And Helen is this character in both the Iliad and the Odyssey, which she seems to be, how do you say it? She almost seems to not equivocate, but she's almost kind of vanilla. Like, where does she stand? And Heidi, I think, was really good on it. I mean, Heidi's pointing out, if you were in Helen's shoes and you were kind of, you're a war captive, In a lot of ways, you're a war captive. You cannot speak your mind and expect to have your life remain safe. And I feel a little bit, though Amelia is obviously very different than Helen, she, I think, is in circumstances that are comparable. She is married to Iago, and she surely knows at least part of his nature. And Iago has this plan, yet she also seems to have affection for Desdemona, genuine affection for Desdemona. And so how is Amelia going to, how is she going to navigate this?
Yeah, we can talk a bit perhaps about that conversation they both have about virtuous wives and what lens they would go to kind of advance their husbands. And Amelia says some shocking things, so perhaps we could look at that. I think a comparison between Helen and Desdemona is really interesting.
Oh, too. Yeah.
I'll have to listen to the podcast. But Helen reminds me a bit of that character in Don Quixote, the beautiful shepherdess who kind of turns up to all these men who are accusing her of ruining their lives, a bit like Helen. And she says, look, beauty as a virtue is neutral. I'm beautiful. If you fall in love with me, that's not my fault. You have to deal with it. And that's kind of the problem that Desdemona has. She's beautiful. Perhaps physically, we're not so sure. I think she is physically beautiful, but definitely her nature is beautiful.
Mm.
And that's the thing that comes under attack. And Iago uses that to his advantage because it's plausible that Cassia would be in love with her and Rodrigo's in love with her.
Yes.
And Iago says a little bit that he is. Can't remember exactly what he says. It's just at the end of Act 2.
What Iago says?
Yeah, about being in love with Desdemona.
I thought it was at the beginning of Act 2, but my memory might have failed me.
It's when he's speaking to Rodrigo. Never mind.
Yeah.
I'll find it another
time. Yeah, we can talk about it next.
He says, now I do love her too. Not out of absolute lust, though peradventure I stand accountant for its greater sin, but partly led to die at my revenge, for that I do suspect the lusty Moor hath leapt into my seat. Yeah. That's what he says. So he says he's going to use Desdemona to win the Moor to renounce his baptism. And so it becomes, as we talked about before, this battle for, almost like a battle for Othello's soul.
Going
to turn Turk, or we're going to be true to his baptism.
Right, right. Boy, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Hey, we could go on, but we can also catch up with what we left on the table next week and the following. Will you be in Canada still next week, or will you have returned home?
I'll be back in England next week. Yeah. Where will you be?
I will be in my cottage in Seattle, I believe.
Sounds bliss.
Yeah, it does. It does. Hey, safe travels to you. This was so much fun. And let's do it again next week for Act 3 of Othello.
Yeah, great to chat to you and speak to you soon.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This is Tim McIntosh for Sarah Jane Bentley and for David Kern in absentia. Thanks for listening to The Play's the Thing, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc. Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.